All right, Matthew, welcome to episode 68 of the Performers Advantage podcast with myself, Dr. Will O'Connor, and Dr. Matt Miller, sports scientist. The Performers Advantage podcast is where we bring sports science to the people. Dr. Matt Miller is an expert in mountain bike science. He is the inventor and creator of Brakeace, the innovative braking power meter and software for analyzing your braking habits throughout a descent. He is also a coach and rider himself, working and racing in the UCI and EWS series around the world.
Dr. Will is an elite ultramarathon runner and a professional coach. He even recently won a 100K running race. What a beast. He also is in a ketogenic diet right now, and he's an expert on the topic. So Will brings across his experience in elite triathlon and is also a Training Peaks coach educator.
All right, this week on the show, we have Dr. Paul Lawson, or Larson. Not really sure, depends on what part of the world you're in.
Come on, can I say it?
Sure.
Can I say it?
Sure.
Dr. Paul Larson. Ah,
thanks, Matt.
That's probably, yeah.
He's North American, so it makes sense.
So he's in Canada, but he was working with New Zealand high performance sport for two Olympic cycles.
That's right.
We saw Paul for the first time at the Training Peaks seminar quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
When we were just young scientists.
It was part of the cycling symposium that they had at the International Velodrome that we have in New Zealand. And yeah, we met him there, fascinating guy, and I went on to work a little bit with him throughout my PhD as the ketone supplement era. Ketosis, low-carb, high-performance sport, leading up to Rio Olympics. But his passion, his expertise are really dedicated to HIIT training, high-intensity interval training. So Matt and I, you know, we're big proponents of training easy. Train easy, get fast. And Paul is big on the hard, short, high-intensity stuff. He did his PhD on it, so we have an amazing discussion around like what defines interval training, how you can apply interval training to get the best bang for buck out of your weekly training session, and also how to recover, what are the demands, and man, a bunch of other stuff, because Paul is one interesting guy.
Yeah, I think we could have talked for about 10 hours. He did have to go, so we kept it at about 1 hour, right, which is our typical podcast. But he's definitely an expert. Like, he's trained athletes in all kinds of sports, so he's bringing his knowledge not only from mountain biking but also in triathlon and running and also team sports, which is really cool. So this is, you know, we usually focus on cycling, running, mountain biking, ultras, that kind of thing, but anyone who is finding this, because HIIT training is so popular now that people are going to come across this podcast episode who are interested in completely different sports. So this is going to be applicable for pretty much any sport, and it's going to be really interesting for everyone.
Yeah, and if you're a little unsure of some of the concepts and topics that Paul touches on when he references physiology, be sure to check out our Performance Advantage podcast masterclass on using sports science to train more effectively, 6-part modular course, as well as our new introductory courses with training and racing with a mountain bike power meter and also running power. So we've got those on our website. Check those out, and that'll really help you follow along if you're a bit unsure about some of the hardcore stuff that Paul is mentioning. But let's get him on. All right, Paul, welcome to the show. Now, how should I address you? Are you still a professor? Are you Dr. Paul? How do we address you?
Paul is good.
Oh, okay.
You're so New Zealander. You're so Kiwi.
Exactly. Yeah. I learned that. That was one of the greatest skills that I learned from you guys is what's the saying you guys have? Is like the tall poppy syndrome?
Yeah.
I learned that quite quickly during my time there. So it's like, it's better to be already cut, just Paul's good.
Yeah, I mean that we've talked about this. We had a junior mountain biker on the show, and you know, so modest and so underrated because you can't, and as a Kiwi, you know, you don't want to say, yeah, I'm pretty good. Like, oh, what? No, you're not.
I mean, you are, but nah.
Exactly. So yeah, lesson learned many times during my my stint in New Zealand. So yeah, Paul's good.
Yeah, and yeah, you're not in New Zealand anymore. You're back in your homeland.
Back in my homeland, back in Canada. Yeah, coming at you from British Columbia, Canada, a little ski town of Revelstoke, BC. And yeah, it's where my wife and child are, and my family. So it was after two Olympic cycles with New Zealand. London and Rio, then it was time to head back. And this is, yeah, where I've sort of building my business, similar to you guys, a bit of a coaching business and then an education business too with Hit Science. Decided to write a book as well called The Science Education of High Intensity Interval Training. There it is. It's a good door stub as well. Very heavy.
It's a thick book. So is that going to be a text? Well, is it a textbook or is it?
It is.
Okay, cool.
It's a textbook, but it's also it's not just a textbook, but it's also kind of like a coaching manual as well for like, so here's the science of how HIIT works. And then here's how you apply it also in 20 different sports. So it's used by coaches and, yeah, I guess astute athletes and certainly sports scientists as well.
Are you, cool. Have you been working with, you just mentioned just on the fly that you worked with two Olympic cycles with New Zealand. Have you been involved in the most recent Olympic cycle with Tokyo?
No, not. I mean, I was coaching one Kiwi marathoner who's trying to make it. But again, the trials, I forget, he was kind of trying to. He was racing for like May 1st deadline to run a sub 210 basically, 211, and it's, you know, it got canceled. He was in Africa, Europe, ready to go. So, but otherwise, no. I've really been focusing on the book and course and my own sort of Ironman triathlon coaching stuff mostly.
Yeah, I was gonna say, man, you got out at the right time. That would have been an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, totally. I've been in touch with a few folks from High Performance Sport New Zealand and other Olympic programs, and it's really devastating what they've gone through. Athletes, of course, as well, big time. And yeah, what a debacle, just all around the world, right? Like it's just the domino effect. We're all feeling it, and it's 2020, right? You just kind of keep saying, "Oh, 2020."
Well, not just Olympics; it's everyone, every athlete around the world, isn't it? In every sport
and every coach as well, because the athletes are affected, then there's no events and people losing their jobs. There's no, you know, it's the whole, you really learn about what a recession really is. You really learn about the importance of the economy, the hardware. So we've all learned it. And yeah, it's not sure how long it's going to take to get back. But There's only this moment. There's only today. So let's see what we can do right now.
I think it's going to be pretty interesting, actually. Will and I always are talking about how everyone needs to train easy. But obviously, your book is about training hard. And I know that you've been a successful coach, coaching athletes in a lot of sports. So I think we're going to actually have an interesting discussion here about the different like kinds of training.
We'll see if we can put our two sort of philosophies together and see if we can come out learning some things at the end.
Yeah, my prediction, I'll just make a prediction right now that they're not going to be that different.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah. So we haven't talked about this yet, but that's my prediction. So
the popular culture, right? Like polarizing, like, oh, man, we're easy training. Paul's all about hard. And then you talk to the person, they're like, oh, nah, yeah. They actually do like quite a lot of intervals, and Paul does do like a long ride.
Paul, we went to a talk that you gave, this was maybe like 6 years ago, that you gave a talk on training for mountain biking at, I think it was a WKO5 or something seminar with Hunter Allen.
Yeah.
I remember you gave the talk. There was a mountain biker that you were working with. I think it was Karen.
Carrie, yeah. Carrie Pye.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So I guess what I'm kind of wondering before we kind of get into your new book is like, what is your background in working with different athletes. It sounds like you work with some runners and like your background in science. Can we just like give the quick autobiography before we get into the book?
For sure. Well, it actually sets up the book pretty nicely because that's, I came really as a failed triathlete, right? Like I'm a classic semi-pro. I was actually like doing triathlon in the early days, back in the late 80s, early 90s. And then I had it was on the cards that it was going to be an Olympic event. So I had the dream, I was like, make it to the Olympics in triathlon. And long story short, didn't happen. So what do you do when you don't make it as a pro? You turn to sports sciences. So I did my sports sciences at UBC, bachelor's, master's in Vancouver. And then I got a scholarship to Australia. And it was like a full ticket, full ride to do my PhD down there. And Aussies were really kicking goals at that time too, right? Because it was the whole AIS kind of thing. And so I went down there and did PhD. And the
when was this? Like what era?
Kind of? That was 2000 I went down.
Oh, right. And, so just after they had injected a lot of funding for the Olympics and everything.
Totally. Yeah. For Sydney and stuff, right? So yeah, I was there at the time that Sydney was kind of happening. And yeah, it was almost like the peak of the success of the AIS. It was all kind of coming together for that Olympics. And anyways, it was a good time to be in Oz. So I was at UQ in Brizzy, and the topic I chose was high intensity interval training, basically, because I was, my big question was like, how do you go and form like your training session, and what training session gives you the most bang for buck? Because obviously it wasn't happening for me in my own, experimentation with just trying to train hard all the time, basically. And that wasn't working, and nothing I did. And I needed to investigate it myself. Right. So I really went down the whole road.
That was after you tried
to run experiments.
Training harder than that.
Oh, totally. So I was the guy that was basically, the whole philosophy is train long and train hard. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then works. You fail at the race, and you're like, now I need to train harder.
Yeah. It was more like, okay, how do you shape the session? Like, like what's the input? If you're going to do a HIIT session, what is kind of like the bout intensity, the bout duration, the recovery intensity, the recovery duration? There's so many ways to skin the cat, right, when it comes to any training session. But basically is, could you get a better adaptation if you skin it one way versus the other way? And that's what I really wanted to try to figure out. And that's what I started doing experiments on big groups of cyclists, actually, and during my PhD, where we're manipulating different sessions and, manipulating what's called like time at VO2 max during HIIT sessions, whilst, keeping a blanket level of, easy training kind of going on. That's where it all started for me. It was really at the University of Queensland in Brizzy. So that started there. And then I basically did 7 years or 6 years as a prof after that, University of Ballarat, ECU in Perth. And then that caught the attention, plus a recommendation from Dave Martin to the New Zealand government, which was forming high performance sport. They had a vision for HPSNZ at that time. And then they headhunted me, whatever you want to call it, and came on over and started there from the end of the Beijing cycle to the beginning of the London cycle, built my team, and then did Rio cycle as well before kind of coming back and doing the book and course. So that's a Coles Note version of the last 20 years. Yeah, the last 20 years, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, obviously loads of experimentation. So the other step that kind of missed along the way was my colleague, Martin Bichette, and from France, and he came over to ECU with me on a research grant scholarship sort of thing. Over to Perth, and we started sort of our real collaboration on manipulating these factors even further to really look at short intervals and repeated sprint training. And using a lot of the tools, really looking at how the desaturation of oxygen in the muscles that occurs across different different interval stuff, looking at the heart and how it's functioning. So we really started to get an insight into the physiological responses in all these different HIIT sessions, and then the resulting adaptation, having a look at these. And we formed this big research, field between us and other colleagues. And then we wrote a two-part review. I'm not sure if you've seen it. It's basically the book in sort of looking at the aerobic response and then also the anaerobic and neuromuscular response. And it's in a two-part review in Sports Medicine. And that was very popular. And that caught the interest of the publisher, Human Kinetics, who asked us to write the book. And then we were both busy and we said no and kept saying no. And they kept asking us. So we said, all right, when I go back to Canada, I'll take on the task of writing this with Martin, who's working at Paris Saint-Germain Football Club, which is a big football club in Paris. So that's sort of how the evolution happened with respect to writing that book. And then we did a course as well. So we've got a course that we teach this as well. HIIT training. So that's, long way.
So that's
intro.
What brought you here.
That's what brought me here to chat with you guys. Yeah, that's what I've been doing the last 6 years.
I guess when I'm listening to that, I'm thinking, okay, maybe a good place to get into it is to talk about what's actually happening when we're going hard.
Before we kind of answer that, let's talk about like the definition of going hard with HIIT. So let's okay. talk about what HIIT is defined, because you started with that question way back. And so high intensity interval training is technically defined as exercise, bouts of exercise that are in your red zone. So these are actually above maximal lactate steady state, critical power, critical velocity, FTP, whatever you kind of want to call it. But the actual exercise intensity has to, in your bout, by definition, has to be above that marker in order for it to be technically HIIT training. Of course, the other fundamental aspect of it is that these bouts of exercise, they're not sustainable, right? Because it's, you reach that VO2 slow component, et cetera, and you're recruiting fast twitch muscle fibers. It's not sustainable. So you have to separate these bouts of exercise by periods of relief or recovery. And what has been discovered is that if you perform this exercise that's in your red zone in a broken way, it is in fact, you can do actually more work than if you were going to try and sort of sustain that red zone intensity for a long period of time. So that's HIIT by definition. So and the other,
so obviously it's a bit of a catchphrase now, isn't it? Like a buzzword or something like that, HIIT. You go out to the park and with a group and you do HIIT, or you're not just people at the park, but see them doing it. And not to minimize like the value of HIIT training, but it's like something that anyone can do. They get a lot of work done. And you're saying, I guess what we're kind of going to get into is like, obviously elite athletes are also using this as well. And it's just kind of taking off a little bit, isn't it?
Well, yeah. So this is the problem, is that if you first talk about HIIT training, based on media, and Instagram, et cetera, like you're thinking of the big muscle guy or gal that's in the gym doing the group fitness thing, and they're working out super hard, and there's weights involved and dance moves and who knows what else, right? Like you just, that's what's sort of taken over. And that was never the intent. I mean, that's really like chapter one. We start with the history of HIIT, and it started in like the 1920s with the endurance runners and the coaches that were kind of manipulating these on the track, and they were figuring out, oh, this is an interesting way to do a little bit more work at the higher sort of pace, and we can push your threshold and you can run faster if you do this broken format, right? Like that's how it sort of started. But it was never like, I never had the idea that it would turn into what it is now thought of by the majority. That's not
okay.
What HIIT,
that's good to clear that up.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
It's good to start by clearing, because basically we're talking about the hard interval sessions that everyone's already doing anyway.
Yeah.
Right. We're not talking about the dance moves and the things, because I did one of these video things during lockdown. We couldn't really do much. And I can't remember what brand it was, but they had these trainers on stage and they were all muscled up with these microphones and they looked super legit and they were cycling through the trainers. So I did the video with my girlfriend and I couldn't even finish it. It was so hard. And
yeah,
I was like, you know, even the trainers can't do it. It's so hard. Like we're dancing around, jumping, squatting. And I was like, I can't keep up. I had to take a nap, you know?
Yeah.
That's not what we're talking about.
Well, that's yeah. That's a type of hit, I guess. But that's, you know, that would be a classic, what we would call in hit science, a type four session. All, you know, it's like an Armageddon workout. It's all guns blazing. It's, and this is the whole thing that I mentioned to so many people and that understand this area and this, the two separate thoughts on what hit is. And it's not about the no pain, no gain. You know, you should always leave your session like you could do one or two more. Like it's, you're hitting the target and you're walking away and you're kind of going back into the easy sort of calm zone. There's great adaptations to be had, but if you're going to the well every time, like you're really putting yourself backwards. And again, go back to when I was a 20-something athlete, that was what I was wrongly doing. I've gone down 30 years of this journey to learn that what you and your listeners can know right now. It's just, it's not about no pain, no gain. It is about the easy training that you're saying, but you can actually, get a little bit more bang for buck if you know, the polarized training, if like, you know, 10 to 20% of your training is actually done in this broken format, not to the well, but you hit the targets at the top end. And then there's, yeah, we can kind of go into different ways that you can skin the cat quite nicely to get a few more of these little bangs for a buck. And we could also start with the physiological adaptations that you would get. So you can, we can all understand why it would be actually of benefit.
When a lot of people are hearing intervals, right? Got intervals. All right. I'm going for these, you know, and it's really hard because we'll get into it about, they all have their specific target and they sit within a training plan, within a month of training, within a year's cycle, you know, and it's not about how do I produce my personal best 1K. Now I'm thinking about running here, you know, like a classic one's like 5 1Ks. For a lot of runners is anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes and you want to kind of achieve that session, or maybe you can correct me, within like the realm of comfort, I guess, of that discomfort, comfortable feeling and recover. And if you are absolutely spent by interval 3, because you went above the coach's targets, which you think is amazing, and then you haven't elicited the most benefit out of that session. So do you think there's a disconnect between maybe the understanding of interval training and the science or application of it?
Oh, for sure. And that's the bridge that we're trying to close with the book, because it is titled The Science and Application of High Intensity Interval Training. So we're outlining, in the first 10 chapters, we outline the science of how you can push and pull the levers of HIIT training sessions to manipulate the physiological response. And then we're also showing it in 20 different sports on how you would actually apply that to those different sports. And it's not just us that are showing that application. Like it's me and Dan Plews who do the sport of triathlon. It's Martin who does the sport of, you know, football, soccer, but it's, and again, it's, then we're fortunate that we have a great network and we're connected to other experts in the world. And a lot of people won't use certain HIIT formats that we outline because that doesn't belong in their context. So yeah. And then they sort of show how those kind of the science still in certain types of formats will fit into their sport. So yeah, there's a massive disconnect to your point between the science and actually how we apply it within any different context. We always say context first over content. So context first.
I've been licking my chops here to get into the science and the physiology of what's happening.
All right, so, should we do it?
Yeah, let's do that. So I think that's, you know, because we always talk about what's happening when we do easy training, kind of the physiology of that and why it's beneficial. So if we can talk about what's actually happening in the muscle with the cardiovascular system,
yeah,
and that kind of stuff when you're going hard, and then kind of compare and contrast that to what's happening when we're going easy. Is that
a good way to do it? You have some types. You mentioned Matt's dance training as type four. Should we start there? Like type, what's type one? Is there a type one?
There sure is. Yeah. To understand the types, we do actually need to start at the physiological factors, because those form the types. So we'll start with the physio. So we break HIIT and the exercise response down to three key variables. If you have to kind of simplify it, this is how we've simplified it. So the first variable, first physiological variable that you can hit or target, we say, is your aerobic system. When we're talking about the aerobic system, we're talking about, to Matt's, what he just mentioned, basically that you're giving a response to the heart. So there's cardiovascular input, right? There's a bigger, load from the cardiac output, stroke volumes increased, heart rate's up. That's one. And then the other, we're not done with that one. There's also, of course, stuff happening at the muscle as well. So we're desaturating the O2 content at the muscle level. And that, of course, we're getting a kickback as well from all of the signals that you guys will be familiar with, right? Like, so AMPK, calcium, PGC1 alpha, et cetera. So you get more mitochondria ultimately. So that's our aerobic bucket, so to speak. That's variable number one. And then variable number two is your anaerobic lactic variable, physiological variable. We also know that we can, you know, push that anaerobic exercise intensity quite high as well. And in this situation, where of course we're burning sugar, we're burning our muscle glycogen, and then lactate is the spillout. And importantly, we get a big, that's not always that sustainable. This is the problem. This is the thing that really gets us into trouble. We've been speaking about how hard training runs us into issues, is because when that big lactate spillout happens, it's associated with a big sympathetic burst in the whole, you know, nervous system, that is great and needed in certain sports, but you can certainly get too much of a good thing. So it's why it's probably the most, what's one of the two that we really have to pay close attention to when we're forming our sessions, when we're shaping our puzzle piece as a training session. And then the last variable, also very important, which is coupled with the lactic system, is the neuromuscular or musculoskeletal system. So think about big recruitments. You're going into your larger fast twitch muscle fiber units. And think about the muscle damage sometimes that you can feel for days after a big hit sort of session. That's the neuromuscular variable that we're talking about. So three key physiological variables that can be hit or targeted in any given hit session, depending on how you skin it. All right, so you got three key physiological variables. Remember, aerobic, anaerobic, and neuromuscular. Now, if we want to go with type one, that is one that you're only really targeting the aerobic system. You're really only getting an aerobic response from that, which is kind of cool that you can actually form HIIT to do that. And this is where knowledge of how we manipulate the levers, work to rest, is really quite useful. Because if you actually turn on the gas for only like 10 or 20 seconds, and then separate it by a pause that's quite long, like almost equal thereafter, like, and these are going to form like a short interval session, you actually keep the lactate at bay. This was Astrand and colleagues in the 1960s that really discovered this. And they found that when you actually were doing formats where you're doing like, say, 10 on, 20 off, or 20 on, 40 off, repeatedly, you could actually still be at VO2 max, yet your blood lactate was sitting down around 4. So just imagine that, right? Like from a, like that, when Martin and I first, you know, learned about that, that was, we were just blown away. It was like, holy cow, that is incredible. Because you got, we're so familiar with VO2 max tests, right? Where you can typically associate with end lactate values of 8 to 18 or whatever, right? Like that's really going to the well, but you can still be at VO2 max in a short interval session and yet have quite a low lactic level. So this is just kind of giving an example. That's a type one session. And then the type two session is when you, we're going to sort of throw in the neuromuscular variable to that too. So you, in a team sport context, we'd add a change of direction to the prescription, say, for example. Type three, we're going to throw in also the lactic response. So now you're just changing the short interval format. So maybe going 40-20, for example, but doing it on a bike. So there's less neuromuscular componentry to the session. So now you're not going to get muscle damage, but you're still working on the glycolytic system at the same time as the aerobic system. Type four, we talked about, there are almost all of these ones that we do. The 5x1K that you mentioned, it would be a type four. The fitness circuit workout that you mentioned, Matt, would be a type four. And then a type five is going to be the anaerobic and the neuromuscular one. And this would be like the classic Burgermeister or Gabala, 30 seconds on, 4 minutes off kind of thing. All out, just all guns blazing there. So really, really spilling out the lactate, getting a big neuromuscular response. And those are our sort of our five types. So we use those ones when we know what the physiological target or response is going to be in any of these sessions. It really can allow us to, it can kind of give us insight into where you can place certain sessions in a program so that you can still keep aerobic system up, because you always want to do that. It's the same principle as you're using for training easy. But sometimes it's also beneficial to keep the other systems going, at least in a high performance context, right? You need to get the regular hit of the neuromuscular and anaerobic lactic system sort of at a regular dose if that's needed for the sport, but you don't want to do it too much, right? And we're all individuals too, so it just helps with our programming a little bit if we're paying attention to those variables. So it helps, yeah, for us it just helps knowing those different ones.
I'm thinking I'm Joe Bloggs and I'm thinking, yep, that 4 and 5 sounds really good because I'm going really hard, and so I'm going to probably do a lot of that. And then obviously the things that you're saying about type one, type two, type three, they also sound really beneficial. So I can go hard, but not do a lot of damage. So I'm also going to do those, right? So do type 4 and 5 today. Tomorrow I'll probably do type 1 and 2. And then obviously I need my long ride on the weekend with my friends, and that's going to end up being in zone 3. So I'm going to be going at tempo pretty much the whole time, because that's what happens when you ride with your friends. How soon till I'm in trouble with that kind of approach?
Well, I think it actually sounded like a pretty good approach, because you got it. Like you did the two, you made sure that you got the, at least during the week when you were talking about how you manipulated the type 1, 2 and the 3, 4s, like you were putting spaces between those. And that's the whole idea, is that you don't want to be doing type 4s and type 5s and even type 3s, you got to be careful with too, all the time, right? Like you need to be making sure that these systems, right? These three systems need certain amounts of recovery. But they don't all need the same amount of recovery. Some of them benefit by more loading, right? Like, because you're going to get a better bang for buck, so to speak, and a larger trajectory towards adaptation that you might be after. So yeah, with the exception of the chasing your friend on the weekend when you know you shouldn't have, it didn't sound too bad.
Yeah. Okay. So I like how, so that's the type one that you talk about. Is that like going to feel pretty easy then?
Yeah, totally. I did one yesterday on the track. So I was using my watch, but basically, and I'm an old man now, so I'm just trying, I'm kind of doing this to, slow down the Grim Reaper is coming to get me. And so I did a type one session. So I was going 10 on pretty hard, right? Like RPE 8 to 9 out of 10, and then 20 seconds off, almost like down to kind of a coasty sort of walk, jog, and then pick back up, right? But these, you know, my 10 seconds on, I'd probably be coasting up to, you know, close to 4 minute Ks, which is good for an old 50-year-old sort of thing. So like, yeah, like it's, but it was, yeah, I get a great response from that. I feel great. And there's really low stress. I don't feel like I did anything yesterday. It just feels super good. I feel energized. And that's the way you should do a HIIT session. You're not leaving these types of type one sessions at all. Like they're hard, but you do get the target hit, the physiological adaptation. And it's not just like the muscle and heart stuff too, like the, you know, the brain and immune system that you're function that you're getting, you know, the anti-inflammatory effect that you get is now well documented as well.
So if we compare that, I have a session similar, it's called the 2020s. Everyone's always so surprised at how they get through. I'm not sure, it depends how fast you are, obviously, but broken up with like a little bit of rest, and there's 2 15 sets. I think you get through about 5Ks like in total once you've completed them. People are like, wow, yeah, my 5K time like is pretty legit. Like, but I was only going 20 seconds hard. And then some of like my super engaged athletes are like, you don't even slow down to what you think you're slowing down to, you know, because you're right. A lot of people are hitting 4 minute Ks, below 4 minute Ks when we're talking about running. And then only coming back to like 5 minute Ks, but it feels like 6, and you can do this continuously. But how does that correlate? Like it's amazing. You're talking about the huge like benefit you can get across different systems. But how does that compare to, if we say it's that session took you 45 minutes, we do a 45 minute zone 2 workout, whether this is bike or run, whatever. What do we have to gain and what do we have to lose? Like, where's that comparison? Because otherwise I'm thinking like what's Matt saying with Joe Bloggs, he reads your book and, you know, you take the information you want and you think, well, I'm not going to do any more like zone 2 or zone 1, zone 2 rides or runs. I'm just going to throw in a whole bunch of 2020s, 10-10s or whatever. Like, how do we compare
those? My guess
would
be that Joe probably didn't read the whole book, I'm guessing. So hopefully, Paul, he'll tell us what chapter he missed.
Well, he must have missed Phil Mathdone's chapter, is chapter 7. So if you know Phil, he's kind of, he does math training and whatnot. But anyways, it really depends back to the first and foremost, the context. So Joe Blog's method could actually be really beneficial more in the team sport context, because they don't have the time that we are blessed with in the endurance, typically in the endurance sport sort of world. The other thing for the Joe Blog person that's just doing the short sort of HIIT sessions, they might be like time crunched because they might be a business person as well. And in that sort of scenario, they also might be, that might also kind of suit their context as well. But for those of us that are blessed with a little bit more time on our hands, there's great benefit to be doing the long, slow distance math training sort of stuff as well, because typically we get these longer periods in, under a bunch of different things, but these higher rates of fat oxidation, lower levels of blood glucose, all the various different signaling that occurs from that. There's probably also a neuromuscular componentry with respect to time on feet as a runner, time on the, you know, in the saddle for a cyclist, and all these things go towards contributing to the performance that we're after. Typically, if we're going to speak like triathlon, say for example, or even mountain bike as well, right? Like you need these components too. So context is first, and I can see sort of a benefit for different people depending on where they're coming from.
But what about the 45 minute, you know, we've got that 45 minute block of time. Now, yeah, I should probably give you more context. We'll paint. We did, Matt, we should go back to Steve. Our So we did this episode training for Steve, and Steve was our hypothetical stereotypical athlete. And this I'll give you the context for Steve, and people who listen to this will enjoy it because they can relate back to Steve. And Steve had an enduro mountain bike race, but he'd also has a half marathon to do a week after it's it was the week after, wasn't it? Yeah, it was the week after the enduro, and it was a one day kind of all day enduro mountain bike race, and he had the opportunity to train four times a week, and now we've got four sessions. He's got an enduro mountain bike. He's also got a half marathon, and we're trying to help Steve out. Right now,
he also has limited time to train.
Yes,
as well.
Yes,
so he has those 4 days.
Yeah,
in the week he has like no time. The weekend he has a little bit of time.
Got it. So what's he got? Like an hour on each day during the week, and he's got his weekend. So it's kind of like Saturday, Sunday, and then he's got two midweek training sessions.
You must know Steve. Do you know?
I've got a few Steves on the books.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
yep,
we
that's
had
him.
6 weeks, didn't we? I think. Yeah. It was about six to 8 weeks. And as history was, he always ran a bit, but not a lot. You know, he had done a half marathon. He didn't prepare appropriately, but he got through in 2 hours. So it's like pretty fit, you know. Went out a bit hard. He was underprepared, so died a bit. And so, yeah, I think you've got all the context there.
So what's the question? How do we form the training for him?
We don't want to go all the way down that path. We have that episode and hopefully it's appropriate. I guess when we've got that athlete and so we pretty much associated two mountain bike sessions and two running sessions. Now, is it going to be appropriate for him to do a zone two run at all? Like, or should, as the bang for buck out of someone who's training, I don't want to say that little because that's just what he has available. I don't want to demean the amount that he's doing at all. But yeah, what, or should it all have some kind of interval component in it?
No, I would do the weekend. I would do midweek. I would have your interval session because you got the shorter time. So it makes perfect sense to put in your interval session on during the midweek, so those 1 hour sessions for both. So you know, I do a bike interval session, you know, something like a 30-30 or a 30-15, and then same sort of thing for the run. Probably like a 40-20 or something like that for the run is me, and then again a longer run on the weekend, Saturday or Sunday, depending on how he wants to skin it.
And why would you? Yeah. Why would you not go something, you know, I'm thinking he's got a half marathon. It's going to take him ideally under 2 hours. There is a high proportion or component there of like your, that nebulous of like the anaerobic aerobic threshold, like it's going to be lactate accumulation, buffering capacity. Now you're not going for something like a 3x10s or, you know, 3x2K or 8 minutes or 2x15 minutes, something where there's that lactate threshold sweet spot, I guess you could refer it to it as. You're going for like seconds in duration.
Yes.
Why is that?
Yes. Because there's a few studies that are coming out from Bent Rolstead's lab that are showing quite nicely the getting more bang for buck from a short interval session versus a long interval session. It's convinced, the data is strong enough that it's kind of convinced me. And again, my own experimentation with my athletes, really like the short interval format a little bit more, but it's kind of like there's aspects of the long interval that are in the short interval format too, because you're doing bouts of these or a series of these short intervals followed by like a 2 to 3 minute kind of recovery between them, right? So you might like you might do like 7 by 30-30 or 7 by 40-20 in a short interval format. And you're just kind of rising, you're a little bit above that maximal lactate steady state or critical velocity in the running kind of context. And then easy during the off period.
Yeah.
And it's just, again, keeping lactate a little bit lower. It seems to be getting a little bit more bang for buck, because remember, every time we're having those long bouts, those long periods of work that are above the lactate steady state, we're really pushing into the type 3, type 4 sort of sessions. So if we can change those type 3, 4 sessions into more type 1, 2s, where they're not as stressful on the athlete, and it seems to be a better bang for buck, more kickback during the recovery. Again, the same principle we spoke about, not going to the well as much in those ones. Don't have to be, you know, no pain, no gain.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. Like if we had the 2 kilometers, let's say, and it's going to take anywhere from 7 to 10 minutes, depending on the individual. If you're breaking that up into 10 to 30 second intervals with the recovery, I can see in my head the athletes that definitely I work with, that it's minimizing their potential to overdo that 2 kilometers or that 10 minutes, right? Because very similar to my run-walk approach to endurance running, is you kind of have that opportunity to reevaluate.
Yeah.
And reassess like how hard you're going, what's the actual goal of the session and yada yada. Yeah. But by the end of it, yeah, I can see how that application, just, I mean, that's just kind of like the actual application of the interval is going to be more appropriate and induce a more specific demand or like adaptation that we're looking for, as opposed to like, oh man, I hope they don't go too hard for this like whole entire 10 minutes.
Totally. And the other little tweak that you get too, we're kind of comparing short intervals to long intervals. The intensity or the speed that you're actually able to go at is just marginally higher in the short interval versus the long interval, because the long interval is the same sort of issue that you spoke about in the individual that did the 5 by 1s, and his last two were really kind of poor, right? He's really kind of fading. Well, it's the same sort of thing. You can go a little bit harder in those ones, and that break period is just enough to kind of recover the whole system, put it back into some sort of little bit of homeostasis before it kind of rises back up again. And actually, one thing we left out in the physiology, because we can speak physiology here, is the myoglobin. So we always forget about this really important physiological protein called myoglobin, which is like the hemoglobin of the muscle, and it's really quick to resaturate in it when it's in the muscle when it is paused, and it basically is the huge game changer, because it resaturates really quickly following a pause, and that is in fact what keeps the blood lactate at bay, because in the time that you've taken to walk or just turn your legs over easy on the bike, the oxygen that's present in the bloodstream quickly resaturates, and it's there in the myoglobin, in the muscle, right by the mitochondria, ready to boom, you know, give you that aerobic energy that you're kind of after without dipping into any of the, the cytosol for the glycogen around the muscle fiber. So that's really powerful kind of, I don't know, understanding to kind of grasp is the appreciation of the myoglobin that's sitting in there for those short intervals versus the long intervals.
I haven't thought about that for so long, actually. It's good to be reminded, because I'm currently back on my ketosis diet, and that, you know, I've been able to nail all of my interval sessions, but then comes to when I wasn't doing cyclic ketosis, like so cycling carbs in the weekend, when I was getting the full adaptation, you know, I'd get to anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes, depending on how I was going, and just die, you know, just completely fall off a cliff. But then I was completing 20 to 30 minutes of work intervals in ketosis without having that same cliff-like reduction in capacity, exercise capacity. So that's mm-hmm. kind of reminding me of why that would be occurring.
Yeah. So for sure, I'm a big ketosis guy myself, as you know.
I do know, and we won't. We'll
go there.
We won't go.
That's
there.
A story for another day, isn't it?
Yeah, cool. The other thing I was going to mention for you, Adam, too. So working with Karen Hanlon in the day, like that is a big one. So 30-15s were her favorite sort of session in terms of a short interval. And we found some really big bangs for buck in terms of her performance outcomes when we were having that one in as a regular cycle in her weekly microcycle. So yeah, she was that was a, and again, those were in kind of the days when I was really just still sort of experimenting with the use of these. So but yeah, it was we got a really great bang for buck from old Carrie Pye.
When you say 30 seconds, I'm thinking like there's a fine line here between like doing these intervals at the right intensity and kind of going too hard. And this is where I'm seeing like maybe this is a really big benefit of now that everyone has a power meter. We can actually do these intervals appropriately, because if we are doing this with heart rate, like the heart rate response to exercise is so slow. So we go hard, it takes our heart rate a long time to go up. And if we're targeting, say, an anaerobic level heart rate, we're going to have to go really, really hard to get up there really quickly. So this is where a lot of us mess up training with heart rate, is we go super hard to get our heart rate up to the working level. Then as we try to keep our heart rate around this working level, we have to reduce the intensity to not then on paper with heart rate go too hard for that set interval. So if you're doing these, when I'm thinking about HIIT training, thinking about doing it with a heart rate monitor, I think it'd be so easy to go too hard and then later on in the session go too easy. But with a power meter, you can probably hit that right target. So do you think...
Absolutely.
So could we talk about like how power meters have kind of helped with this? And then maybe like how you would apply it to make sure that you're at the right level, maybe with that 30-15 session that you're talking about?
The best practice, in my opinion, is to basically be using both, because as you would see, is if you're using a power meter and a heart rate monitor, you're actually able to see the evolution of both of these variables, and they're not in parallel, right? Like obviously when you're doing that first 30 seconds and second 30 seconds on, you're not seeing much of a change in the heart rate because we have what's called a heart rate lag, like heart rate slow to get up there. So, so you know, it takes sort of time, but what you do find is that, you know, in a 30-15 kind of session, typically you're doing the power output in the 30 seconds, you're doing it like at 110% of the power that's associated with your VO2 max. You know, it might be 130% of your FTP, if you know that, as a guess, 30, yeah, about that. And it's so it's up there, and then you're seeing these consistent spikes, hopefully in the power output. You're hitting the same, 30 second bouts all the time if you're experienced and a consistent athlete. And then the heart rate just kind of slowly gets up there. And this is where these extra adaptations kind of happen, because go back to the physiological response, even during the rest periods where the myoglobin's resaturating, the heart's still pumping quite hard in these times, and you're getting almost these free adaptations because the heart rate is kind of in what we call as a heart rate lag status, and it's continuing to beat hard, the stroke volume's still high, cardiac output's still high because it's working to recover the system. So you see this as almost this steady increase and then a plateau in these repeated 30 second bouts, but then power is kind of always the same. And then you finish the series or the number of bouts and you take your recovery. And then once again, you get this lag in a heart rate inertia, and the heart rate sort of slowly falls down in the recovery period. And then you repeat and you do your next series of these sorts of things again. So different time courses of evolution. Best practice, as you become more experienced, both coach and athlete, you want to have both of these things kind of going and monitoring both of them. And yeah, and then you see they become easier as well. That's the other thing that's kind of cool. So you'll see these rises in, especially when you don't prescribe it necessarily as a direct power output. You give the athlete a little bit of it should be in around this range and let's see what you do. And then you can actually go back and monitor your data and training peaks and actually see where where these are at in day one versus, one or two or three weeks or the next year, et cetera. And lo and behold, there's usually a rise in these variables, but heart rate will be more or less almost kind of the same throughout the whole thing. But the power output's going is greater because the kickback is that you're making these larger fast twitch muscle fibers more fatigue resistant or aerobic developed. They're getting more mitochondria in them, and then there's more buffering, and it's just easier, and you've got a more powerful athlete.
Are you looking at heart rate, the decline, recovery, and heart rate between sessions? Oh, like between what would we call them? Sets, I guess.
I'm not paying too much attention, but you can look at that. That's your classic, heart rate recovery variable, and you can certainly look at that one. It's similar to looking at heart rate variability. So it's you're looking at the balance of the nervous system. So the faster that's going down, typically you're having a big, a big response from the parasympathetic system. It can also actually be, got to be careful because it can actually be an indication that of parasympathetic overreaching. So there's a lot of sort of things that are going on. You see different responses in different phases. And it's not something I look too kind of closely at unless it's, unless I've got like a problem I'm sort of trying to solve. And then I might look a little bit sort of closer at those variables. But otherwise it's distracting me, I think, from the important things personally. Yeah. I'm more concerned about power.
You sound like me.
Like, I don't think, I just think these would be totally impossible with just a heart rate monitor.
With I'm a big running power guy. I absolutely love it. I think it's the future. And even just the application of, power on these outputs, because now that it can measure wind reasonably accurately in the input, like it's measuring more direct outputs of what you're doing. With mountain biking, we go back to kind of that reference. I'm thinking, mountain biking, you're always doing these short bouts of high power outputs, right? So what about doing these on hills versus flat versus maybe even versus indoor? Like, because your muscle recruitment pattern, muscle load and things is a lot different running or riding up a hill. Do you incorporate that in any way?
Yeah. So if I'm actually prescribing a HIIT session, once again, back to context. So if I've got a limitation in the flat context, we can change the inertial characteristics where we're actually looking at a flat sort of situation, especially in a cyclist where that's maybe important. Then we want to actually do specific intervals in that, low gradient sort of context. So they're moving quickly.
Mountain bikers always suck at it.
Yeah, for sure. Probably because they don't practice them too much, right? And it is an important, you'll know from mountain biking, like you got to get away in that, usually in that for when the gun goes off, we got to move quite quickly through that stage. So in that context, and if that's a limitation, then we need to practice that. So it is good to do some intervals in that. And even from standing too, right? And practicing getting up into into the pedals. So I remember doing that a little bit with Karen. But I would say the majority are done on an incline because you get a bigger sort of physiological response. Like usually the goal of that HIIT session is actually to get a big load on the, you know, on the cardiac tissues and the subsequent adaptation. And you're not probably getting that as much, I don't think, in the flatter sort of context. It's just a little bit harder, and there's not as much grunt that's behind the pedal, if you know what I mean, to grip onto. Like it's just the whole kinetics of the pedal stroke is changed due to the inertial characteristics, I believe.
Yeah, so like when this is why mountain bikers always suck at it, because when they're going up hills, there's it's really high torque and really low cadence, and then when they get out onto the road, and suddenly they need to create this really low torque at, you know, 100 RPMs, and they're just horrible at it. And even though it's the same power, and we talk about this when we talk about the power meters and stuff, but you know, they always struggle with it. But there's a lot to be said for doing an interval up a hill, because that's usually where the races are going to be, you know, won or lost, really, because the speed is low. So if you can go faster, you have more time to gain.
Exactly.
So let's train for it.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, and that's where I believe running power and everything that's come from cycling, that's been implemented in cycling and more recently mountain biking for decades now, is now being applied. We can apply it to running. Like, I can set hill intervals and set power targets. Otherwise, what are you doing? We've established you can't use heart rate because it'll be too slow to catch up and you'll just end up slowing down. We definitely can't use pace, because what's a 6% gradient versus 7% gradient, you know, effect on speed. But now with power, you can say, look, this is what we need to achieve, and this is what we can, you know, need to overcome, and this is what we need to adapt to. And having recently got WK05, which is like for most people listening, the next level above Training Peaks in terms of analytics, I'm looking at power duration curves and seeing these, starting to see better, identify these weaknesses that weren't apparent in like just pace. I don't know how much you know about running power or how much you've used it, but with like the knowledge of your book and the application to running, this is generally how we speak. I speak to kind of running and triathlon, mets, mountain biking and cycling, but yeah, it'd be a game changer for a lot of people's training.
I know that the running power is getting better and better in terms of being something that's actually useful. And I think you've identified where it's actually useful. So it's actually, you know, it's probably useful in terms of applying it to things like HIIT training. I would say that in my experience, and certainly those that have taken on the application chapters in HIIT science, and we have both a middle distance and a long distance chapter. In neither of the authors, who are, you know, elite coaches, you know, including those that have been, you know, helping individuals set world records, they're not actually using that yet. But I think it's only now we're seeing sort of the evolution of the understanding and the evolution of, and like the improved reliability and validity of the marker. Where that's sort of, I'm not sure, using the Stride one. I've heard the Stride is one of the best ones. So yeah. So I think probably that's really something I'm gonna have to have a look at for the second edition of the book, and probably for my own use as well. I'll need to kind of upskill in that. But admittedly I started a little bit with that. I even started a PhD project with a student who was gonna actually validate a few of the Stride meters and some others, but yeah, it just kind of didn't go anything further than that. So I probably need to get back there. But I agree, like all the same similar principles would apply. So I think you're probably going down the right track, Will.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that about running power and like how, and I'm sure it's like a time restrictive thing where you just haven't got knowing you and knowing like your level of expertise, you don't want to just like throw something on and see. You want to like find out what's the algorithm they're using, how applicable, reliability, validity, all yeah. of that, you know, into subject reliability and all of that before you go ahead and use it. But we're there, we're at the point, I'm going to say we as power users, running power users, right back to, I guess, the 2000s of cycling power, where, yeah, there was coaches utilizing or not utilizing power and setting world records, and we have to ignore the era of the 2000s in cycling, but it just wasn't like a thing because people didn't have their head around it, I think, and like what it was, how it was applicable, why you needed to bother. Matt uses kind of the comparison of now everyone in the Tour de France has power, right? You just, they come, it's power meters come on bikes like straight away, and I believe we will get there. It's not a direct measurement, like it's an algorithm. It's, you know, there's margin for error, but in terms of, yeah, the application to training, I think it's an absolute game changer.
You know, I agree. I think it's probably going to go there. Yeah, it's that is the challenge, is the whole first principle thing, as you guys know and probably discussed on others. Like it's yeah, like the, you can use a lot of first principles in, from my memory, with respect to the power meter and the closed loop sort of situation, almost on the, you know, the angular rotation kinetic and all that stuff, or variable. And then with the running one, it's a little bit more challenging from that perspective, with respect to, you know, forces. And yeah, you're making a few more extra guesses, but yeah, like you said, they're getting better and better. And, you know, with sensors and the Hertz rate that they're capturing, and then, you know, the machine learning and et cetera, they're getting closer and closer to saying, oh yeah, this is actually pretty, it's actually pretty accurate to what it should be. And yeah, I remember earlier days I was experimenting with that and they were way off, and that's why it kind of pushed me away. But I hear now like it really, really looks like they've got something there. And you're all, you know, you're onto something too when you're looking at yourself and you're looking at a similar effort, and you're seeing almost that same thing that we spoke about, where we're seeing a similar evolution of the heart rate relative to the power, right? Like, so when your similar effort in a bike looks the same, or similar effort on the run with respect to heart rate and power that's, it's being presented, it's like, I think they got it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. They're definitely onto it. And as one engineer told me, he said, every measurement is an estimate.
Totally.
Right. So even with on the bike power meters, which we totally accept, we're still measuring strain in something that we're pushing with our legs, and we believe it. So power meters on running are getting there. And
yeah.
I think it definitely makes it much easier to do the HIIT training that you're talking about, and mm-hmm. do a really good job at doing it. And with running power meters and power meters in general.
I think I was going to tell you guys, we're working on a technology actually that's kind of helps with training and uses some of the principles in HIIT science. We're trying to make a version two of a Training Peaks kind of thing for both coaches and athletes that uses some of these principles that we profess. And I think, you know, to your point, I think we're going to need to start incorporating the power in some of these estimates and algorithms and whatnot that we're working on. So
tell us more about that. Like I went
Can
on
you
your
get
website.
Into it.
yeah, for sure. So okay. I'm actually looking for, thanks for asking, I'm looking for beta testers actually right now. We're in our third iteration of looking for beta testers, and it's basically an automated training plan program. And we're starting just with an athlete version, but eventually, like, so after we get the athlete version solid and we're happy with it running with my coaching recommendations, there's going to be a coaching version that comes out, and you guys can put your coaching sessions in there. And, you know, the thing will kind of update and provide recommendations accordingly. We're trying to sort of take out some of the heavy lifting that coaches have to do. You know, I think we spoke with, it's not easy being a coach. There's a lot of these things you got to pay a lot of attention to. And we only have, as coaches, we only have so much bandwidth to kind of go in there and look at all these sorts of details. So wouldn't it be nice if someone was kind of behind the scenes that was holding your hand a little bit and sort of showing you a few things that you could maybe pay attention to and do a little bit better. So that's, yeah, that's what we're building. And if anyone's interested in piloting this or helping us out with a bit of feedback, please get in touch. So yeah, get in touch with me, info@hitscience.com, and we'll get you signed up on the platform.
What kind of athletes are you looking for?
Yeah, sorry, I should have. Yeah, triathletes, definitely. So we're starting actually with we're gonna implement it for all endurance sports, but
you're trying the hardest sport with three components.
Correct. We are. We're starting with that, and then the algorithms will be super easy thereafter. Like, so we know it'll work with all of the single sports, but we're starting with the hard ones, the hardest thing first.
So what do you, I don't know how much you can get into it, but you're obviously looking for someone to input their training history, like variables, like these people need to be using heart rate monitors, power meters.
That's a really good point. So yeah, only get in touch with us if you've got like a Garmin kind of device and you're hooked up to Garmin Connect. So they integrate with the Garmin Connect system. Reason we've gone by that is that Garmin has 80% of the market. So it works out well. You basically hook up your Garmin Connect into our platform. Here the plan will be outlaid and you follow along in the plan.
So you've got the structured workouts set up.
Yep, structured workouts, absolutely. And they're, you know, everything's published, so we're just using everything that's within, you know, our recommendations within kind of the book. And then we've got we use all the load and load response, so classic TRIMP, or you know, Bannister TRIMP, TRIMP modeling in terms of the loading. And then we use all the load response variables as well in the background to change ultimately what the recommended session should be in the following day. And again, we don't just want to have this just for athletes. We want to have this, you know, coaches, you know, we want to have this whole thing for coaches as well. So especially if you're a coach and you have a Garmin Connect, you're the ideal sort of beta tester for us, because you're going to be pretty astute and be able to give us some really frank feedback and how you want to see things as a coach as well for your athletes, and how can we help you with the heavy lifting that you find challenges with too.
Yeah. That's cool. That sounds really cool. I think the future of training is going to be better, and we're going to be faster, and we're going to break new records all over the place. So it's pretty exciting.
We're in such a exciting field, aren't we, guys? Like, we're so lucky to be doing the study that we did.
Well, and the technology advancements, like we think about, you're talking about Garmin Connect, and I'm guessing the structured workout component that gets sent to your device, right? That's been a game changer as a coach, you know, applying workouts to athletes. And as you say, 80% of the market is Garmin, so a lot of people know what I'm talking about. And for those couple Suunto users that I know listen to the show, I've been pushing to get on the Garmin bandwagon. We can apply workouts and, like, say 100% of FTP, right? And that's going to change for each athlete. We now no longer kind of need to specify power outputs, and they know, they get the range, not the direct number. And it allows, like, it's kind of fixed, but it's also flexible and its engagement and application. So I think with your expertise and applying these intervals, and then like more engaging way of being able to achieve them, rather than like having to write them on your hand and sweating it off and not forgetting if it's 60 seconds or 90 seconds recovery. Like, it's a really innovative field. So I'm excited to see what you guys can do.
Totally. And I mean, you just thought of another feature that that we've got going on. That's think of all the challenges sometimes that we have with setting people's zones and getting them just right and whatnot. And again, we've got a, we've got stuff that just takes the guesswork out of there. So actually prescribing the session that is going to determine what your where you're kind of sitting in that zones, whether it be running speed or power output or heart rate. Like, it just kind of, here's the testing session, go do this, and then it's done. And it's and of course it gets refined as the athlete continues down. The more data we get, the more certain we are of where that sort of zone is sitting. But I don't know, there's been a lot of times when I haven't got the zones quite right and it's become obvious, but only later on, way down the road, where I'm actually looking back at the athlete. So again, trying to get rid of some of the heavy lifting and stress that coaches experience and athletes experience too, because they're questioning the coach. And so, yeah, trying to.
Oh yeah. The amount of times I've thought a recovery intensity or duration was long enough for, in theory, what the demands of that interval were. And then I try to get out and do all of the sessions that I set at some point in time. And I do it and think, oh my God, this is so hard. This is far, far more demanding than I wanted this session to be.
And I'm exactly like you. Almost always am doing the session that I'm prescribing before I'm giving that to an athlete. And I've made the exact same mistake as you, as I've just prescribed inappropriately. I was like, oh, that's not possible. So yeah, it's the same thing. I'm actually working with a volleyball team right now, actually UBC Okanagan volleyball team. They play in the national tournament here in Canada, and we're doing some more HIIT prescription with them. And that's another one where I'm now in the gym a lot, and I'm doing all of the HIIT sessions and some of the eccentric works and all those sorts of things, just because I've got to do this sort of myself, because I don't want to make a mistake and injure some of these gals, who've got to play big tournaments and whatnot. So yeah, I think it's a great principle that you're at least trying to kind of do these sessions yourself first. I think that all coaches should do their best to try to do that as well.
Yeah, definitely. So I think, I guess if I were to sum this up, I think we're all kind of on the same page. I don't know. That'd be my vote. What do you guys think with training? So we need those high intensity trainings. Obviously, I really like how you've broken down the different levels. So that's really cool. And definitely I would suggest that athletes and coaches look into those different levels, because I like how that's done. But we definitely need easy training, but we definitely need hard training. And there are definitely benefits to both.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you get the most bang for buck if you are doing both. And again, this is where the whole polarized, I'm sure you guys have done a session on polarized training before.
And it's now a masterclass.
80-20. So yeah, go to the masterclass and review that. So 80-20.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, one of the takeaways, well-timed that we had this chat, because I'd just been looking into some of these aerobic speed sessions or these components of integrating the short, work and rest interval session to make an aerobic session more engaging. You know, when you've got a runner running 160 Ks a week, reproducing a 10K, 15K, 1 hour, 45 minute, 1 hour, 15 zone two aerobic run becomes like monotonous. And also all the way on the other end of the spectrum, coming from someone training, 15 hours a week to someone, Steve, training four times a week, again, it's a bit more engaging. It's a bit more adaptive, hopefully, for those athletes. So I think that's something I'm going to take away.
Well, it was a great conversation, guys. I loved it. And yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, till the next time, eh?
Thanks for coming on, Paul. We'll be doing a keto one for sure, I think.
Perfect. Another one of my favorite topics.
All right, Paul. Well, you enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll catch up another time.
Sounds great. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks heaps for coming on.